It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, if you're a person who's intimidated by the very act of starting a project, there are some surprising reasons why you may be having a hard time. We'll talk about procrastination in, about 15 minutes. But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup. Presidential candidates are starting to make appearances around Wisconsin, and Governor Walker made some comments about his, as of yet, non-endorsement. We'll also get the latest on a sexual assault amnesty bill signed this week and the status of the Elizabeth Kingia outbreak in the state. For more on all of those stories, we're joined by Robert Menzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So presidential hopefuls are descending on the state this week in hopes of winning over Wisconsin voters. And it seems like every day we hear about another planned appearance or a town hall. Ted Cruz made headlines for calling out Donald Trump yesterday in the village of Dane.
But you mess with my wife, you mess with my kids, that'll do it every time. Donald, you're a sniveling coward, and leave Heidi the hell alone.
So what was the setup for that comment?
Yeah, he sounds angry there, and he, you know, he has a right to be. Donald Trump essentially retweeted a follower's fairly disgusting image that was mocking Ted Cruz's wife's appearance. Really sort of sophomoric stuff, but I guess that has been the tone of the primary that we're in, and so this is Cruz responding and sounding genuinely angry and being genuinely angry. Of course, about 2 seconds after that quote, a reporter asked, well, would you still support Trump if he's the nominee? And Cruz didn't say no. So it's a weird situation that we're in.
Well, and this is not the first time that something that Donald Trump retweeted has kind of backfired or come back to bite him a little bit, because he has retweeted things from some white supremacist groups and other things that people said, hey, are you paying attention to who you're retweeting?
Yeah, and he knows what he's doing. I mean, the Trump campaign is premised on the sort of rolling controversies that follow all the time, and this is one. And retweeting a white power people, white supremacist people, is another. And I think it's, you know, at this point, like, it's definitely a pattern. It's definitely a way that that Trump gets attention and sort of demonstrates kind of dominance over opponents. It's just not to the norms of what we expect from political leaders. And it's kind of gross.
And was there any response from Trump after hearing or being made aware of what Cruz said?
Trump is on to the National Enquirer story alleging infidelity by Ted Cruz. Cruz responded to that at a campaign stop in Wisconsin today as well, saying categorically false. And Trump is doing the same, you know, what Trump does, and sort of fanning the flames of that by saying, you know, oh, I don't know if this story's true. It could be true. Maybe it's not true. I hope it's not. But ensuring that people will continue to talk about it.
So other than calling out Donald Trump for those comments about his wife, what else has Ted Cruz been up to in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so Ted Cruz is campaigning hard in Wisconsin. He was he unveiled endorsement by the conservative group Right Wisconsin, the right-wing talk radio guy Charlie Sykes. This is interesting. There was a pretty interesting report that the Journal Sentinel did looking at Trump approval ratings among Republicans in Wisconsin, and Trump is really unpopular in the sort of Milwaukee suburban area, which is also one of the state's most Republican areas. Trump is quite unpopular. That is a contrast between the western and northern parts of the state, where Trump is pretty popular. And so what it amounts to is a more or less head-to-head race between Cruz and Trump, with then Ohio Governor John Kasich coming in significantly below both of them. So Cruz is really, really wants to win the state, but win delegates in the primary here, and sees it as an opportunity because that large conservative center is not Trump country.
And are the Wisconsin delegates awarded proportionally, or are we a winner-take-all state?
It's sort of a, well, it's not winner take all, but it's sort of a mix. There are, it's awarded by congressional district, and then there are some at-large delegates that go to the state's winner. So it's very complicated. You need, one of these math guys who's smarter than me to sort it out, but it's certainly not winner take all.
So you did mention Ohio Governor John Kasich. He has also been campaigning. And here he is in Milwaukee on Wednesday, brushing off talk of dropping out of the race.
Falling behind at fundraising, we've always been the little engine that can. There is zero chance that we would drop out before Wisconsin, and there'd be no reason for us to.
So what do you think Kasich is really hoping to gain in Wisconsin? I mean, I'm guessing that he doesn't honestly think that he's in a position to win, but why stay in for sure through Wisconsin?
Well, Kasich Kasich has an argument in Wisconsin. Ohio and Wisconsin demographically are not so different, and Kasich has the endorsement of former Governor Tommy Thompson, who's still quite popular. Former Governor Scott McCallum here, both were campaigning for him this week. So, just sort of on paper, Wisconsin could seem like it would be a good state for him. Kasich's argument for actually getting the nomination is weak. I mean, he's going to come in third here. He's not close to sort of challenging Cruz for the anti-Trump challenger status. But I think his argument is if Trump doesn't end up with a majority of delegates, if it turns out to be a brokered convention and the Republican convention, that maybe Kasich can make the argument that he is the best candidate going into the general election. So he wants to stay in to try to make that argument if everything goes wild at the convention.
We're talking with Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. And in other news this week, the governor signed a bill that aims to increase reports of sexual assaults on college campuses. What's the approach there?
Yes, so this is quite simply a bill that would grant amnesty on underage drinking charges for any person who comes forward and reports that they were a victim of sexual assault. So, in practice, it's probably not common, and police departments will tell you that they will not ticket someone for underage drinking if a woman says that she was sexually assaulted at a party or on campus or whatever. But this law, removes any uncertainty about that, and it just makes it that it is simply not something that a sexual assault victim needs to worry about. So that's the idea, is it removes one barrier that might cause victims to not want to come forward and report.
Well, and Rob, you just made a really important point. I think this is just one barrier, and if it's not in cooperation with looking at other reasons why victims don't report, and certainly that is a huge problem, do you think that this is going to have a measurable impact?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt about it. It needs to be understood as a small, sort of an incremental type of law. But on the other hand, it's probably better that it exists than not, right? There are a lot of barriers that have to do with social norms and will a woman be believed and shame and everything else. And those are all very complicated and we need to combat those for sure. But they also are hard to quite there's not a simple solution to that. This is not a broad solution. It's not a silver bullet type solution, but it is something that the government can do. They can remove any risk that someone would think that the police are going to disbelieve a woman and end up writing her a ticket.
And finally, Rob, this week, the State Department of Health Services released new information on the Elizabeth Kingia outbreak that's been going on around Wisconsin. First of all, what is Elizabeth Kingia?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a bacteria. So this has been called a medical mystery. This is a new bacteria, just only discovered in 2011, and it's been tied to 59 infections in Wisconsin and at least 17 deaths, I think, in the life of the bacteria. One death in Wisconsin. The thing is, there's not a lot of science on this germ. Scientists are not sure how it spreads. spreads, not sure how to fight it. We do know that it is resistant to antibiotics. We know that it's mainly an issue for, especially for older people, people with compromised immune systems. And so a lot of the spread has been to people who are in hospitals or have otherwise compromised immune systems. But it's nasty stuff. It causes fever and chills and shortness of breath, and it's very it's unsettling to see see it spreading. This week it spread up to Winnebago County. It was the first case in Winnebago County. That's the farthest north it's been in Wisconsin. And so there's a lot of questions around what it is and how to stop it.
Well, we'll certainly keep tabs on that, and we'll look forward to speaking with you next week.
All right, thank you.
That was news editor Robert Menser helping us recap the biggest headlines from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a recent survey showed 41% of women said they cried at work in the last year, and 9% of men said they did. We'll talk to a guest who says it's sexist to look down on people who cry at the office. But first, the world seems to be split into two camps. The people who, when faced with a project, are able to dive right in and complete the task at hand with time to spare. And then there are those who feel the idea of beginning a project to be daunting. They may reorganize a closet or binge watch a TV show to avoid starting something they know they need to get done. For a long time, people in the latter camp have been described as lazy or lacking in willpower. But research shows that it's actually incredibly complicated to begin a project, and that there are a lot of factors at play with something seemingly as simple as just starting. Jane Porter is a freelance reporter based in New York. She recently wrote a piece in Lifehacker about the difficulties of just starting a project. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you wrote about the difficulties of just getting started. What is it about starting a new project or a new task that's so hard?
You know, having that kind of blank page in front of you, having, starting from zero really is kind of the most intimidating part of a project for so many people. But research in neuropsychology has really shown that the root cause of that is different for everyone. So, you know, for me, it might be impulsivity. For you, it might be planning, or it might be, poor orderliness or just having trouble initiating a small task. So it's really, just figuring out what that root cause for starting a task can really take you really far in terms of just getting over that hump.
And I think one of the interesting things is when we often talk about procrastination in a negative sense, whether it's about ourselves or someone else. And, you know, it's kind of seen as a fault. But actually, one of the causes can be being afraid of not being able to do it perfectly. So it's actually having extremely high standards that causes us to not get started.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, perfectionism can be, your biggest enemy in terms of getting started. I have this little quote on my desk from John Steinbeck that says, "And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good." Just this idea that you just have to be okay with not getting everything exactly right, and sort of over-collecting information, that impulse to sort of continue to gather information, to continue to prepare for this thing that you need to do, as opposed to just starting it. Can be a trap that a lot of people fall into.
And in your article, you write that, of course, it's good to gather information that we need to get started, but sometimes that information gathering can be used kind of as an excuse not to get started.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just feeling the need to get it right, feeling the need to sort of have explored every angle, every corner can be a trap that you fall into. So it really is important to be able to kind of take that leap and just get going on whatever your project is, and worry about maybe going back to those details and the nitty gritty later.
So what exactly is happening in our brains when we're procrastinating, when we're having a hard time just starting something?
Sure. So, you know, there's a couple of things going on, and it's really different for every person. But, you know, research in neuropsychology has shown that there are 9 aspects of executive brain function, and any one of those could really be the trigger for you, for me, for anyone in their procrastination. So that could be, you know, shifting from one activity to another. I'm about to sit down and start writing a story, and then all of a sudden I decide I need to check my email, or I need to dust off my desk or organize my papers. You know, that could be impulsivity. You know, I get a phone call from a friend who's nearby who wants to grab a coffee, and I just run off and do that instead of getting started. So really thinking about kind of the root cause of what typically have a pattern of what keeps us from getting started, and kind of really taking a step back and thinking, what is it that usually stops me from getting started? What is it? What's that one thing that usually triggers me to move away, to avoid what I'm doing? That could be Facebook. That could be, you know, social media is often, a trigger for people. Email. And really figuring out what that one thing is, and is kind of the first step in kind of overcoming the hesitation to get started.
We're talking with Jane Porter. She's a freelance reporter based in New York, and she recently wrote a piece in Lifehacker about the difficulties of just getting started on a project. So, Jane, it sounds like often, especially when we have something looming in front of us that we know we should have started and we haven't started it yet, it can be hard to say, you know what, I'm going to take just a little bit of time and figure out what the stumbling block is. But it sounds like you're saying that little investment of time to kind of take that step back and look honestly at what's holding us up is probably time well spent.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, you know, is that it's easy to sort of over-fantasize about the end product. If you're working on a big project, to kind of have this really big ideal in mind. You know, psychologist Jeremy Dean calls it positive fantasies, where you think about the end state of achieving the goal rather than all the steps that you need to take in order to reach that goal. I mean, it's great to think positively, you know, and to dream big and to have to reach high with your goals, but to focus on just the end product without thinking about what are the steps that need to go into this. Is really something that can hold you back from getting started.
I think of it kind of in an analogy of going on a trip. I mean, maybe, you know, sitting here in Madison, I think, okay, I'm going to go to New York City and I'm going to have lunch with Jane Porter. And then the day comes that I've decided I'm going to do that and I haven't made a plane reservation. I haven't figured out where I'm staying. I haven't gotten the time off work. So I had that end goal, but I didn't put any of the steps in place to make it happen.
Right. Yeah. And you know, one thing that can help in sort of countering that is to really define, like, what are the key steps that I need to take? And, you know, and really boiling it down to, like, 3, for example. So having these 3 high impact actions that you need to take. I mean, a lot of times what we'll do is we'll have a to-do list for the day with, you know, 10, 15 things on it, but not all of those 10, 15 things are of equal importance. So really identifying what are those 3 high impact actions that you really need to take. Like, I need to book the flight, you know, and when you get down to it, it's like, well, I could just book that flight. It won't take more than 15 minutes. It won't take more than 5 minutes, maybe. It just kind of pushes away all that other busy work that we sort of let kind of take up all of our time and help us avoid getting started on what really matters.
As we wrap up here, Jane, one of the most interesting things I found in your article was that you say that forgiveness can actually play a big role in alleviating some of that procrastination angst. Who are we forgiving and for what?
So forgiveness is, you know, forgiveness is important, and it's really about forgiving yourself for, you know, getting sidetracked, forgiving yourself for delaying starting the task. You know, it's kind of that sort of idea that people they'll have a New Year's resolution, they'll kind of fall off the track, you know, they'll go off track, and they'll just give it up on it. And, you know, being able to forgive yourself, being able to say, okay, you know what, I got a little sidetracked, but I'm going to get back to the work that I need to be doing, and it's okay. Research has shown that that's really important and a really effective way to just get over procrastination. Don't sort of stew in your, you know, in your kind of regret about it, but just push forward, push through it, forgive yourself, get over it, and get started.
And going back to what we touched on in the beginning, the difficulty is often getting started, but maybe sometimes we don't have to start at what feels like the beginning of a project. When I was writing a lot of history papers in college, I found writing the body was a lot easier, and then going back and writing the introduction and then the conclusion last. So maybe it doesn't always have to go in the same order we think either.
Right. Absolutely. There's no, you know, there's no sort of master map of how to get started. There's no like right first turn to make. It's just about kind of sitting down and launching into it and getting going and not worrying about the end product from the very first moment that you sit down.
Well, Jane, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Jane Porter is a freelance reporter based in New York. She recently wrote a piece in Life Hacker about the difficulties of just starting a project. Well, coming up, we'll talk to a guest making the case that it should be okay to cry at work. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, Governor Walker says a contested GOP convention could lead to a presidential nominee who's not currently in the race. First, we're talking about something you might not want to admit that you do at work.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Well, crying at work can be a touchy subject. If you do it, you might do it privately and without telling anyone. A couple years ago, the Huffington Post interviewed high-profile women about crying at work, and the majority of them said it was a bad thing to do or gave a negative view on crying in the workplace. In fact, the CEO of the Girl Scouts, Frances Hesselbein, said, quote, "Tears belong within the family." In the past year, 41% of women have cried at work, according to a survey. Only 9% of men said they did. Our next guest makes the case that looking down on crying at work is sexist. She says it should be okay to cry at work. And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Have you ever cried at work? What were the circumstances? And how did your colleagues respond? Do you think people changed their opinions about you because you cried? And was it for better or for worse? Do you think it's sexist to look down on crying in the workplace? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post your story on the Central Time Facebook page. Olga Kazan joins us now. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic. Olga, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we mentioned a survey showing women crying more than men at work. Why is that?
Well, there's a few reasons. One is, I guess, some of them are kind of just biological. So women produce more of this hormone called prolactin, which seems to promote crying, and also testosterone suppresses it, and men have more testosterone. And then another kind of strange, weird thing is that men have larger tear ducts than women, so more of their tears can kind of well up in their eyes before they actually spill out onto their cheeks.
And so those are both biological reasons, but I'm guessing a big part of it is social. What are some of the social dynamics that are at play?
Sure. Well, we shouldn't underestimate that, you know, men are socialized from a young age not to cry. But it's largely because it is associated with women and femininity. And then also people kind of, usually when people are crying, especially at work, it's not because they're just sad and despondent. It's because they're kind of sort of experiencing this sort of helpless anger. And for whatever reason, women, when they encounter you know, frustrating situations, they experience this kind of helpless or hopeless anger, and that's according to one researcher that I talked to. But also, you know, when men feel angry, they can kind of explode and pound on things and swear, but women can't really do that, or at least they're penalized for doing that, you know, to the same degree that men are. So their kind of best option is to cry sometimes.
So it sounds like you're saying that the reasons that we cry outside of work, like maybe at home because there's been a loss in the family or a fight with a spouse or something like that, the things that trigger tears at work are a little different, that it's more, it's almost more of a stress response, it sounds like.
Well, actually, it's interesting. So there's, you can't, a lot of people do cry during sad situations like the loss of a loved one, but the most common thing that makes people cry at any time at work or at home is sort of a frustrating situation. So the fight with a spouse is not sad per se, right? It's frustrating.
So why did you decide to write about this issue of crying at work and whether it's okay or not, or whether it should be okay?
I don't know. It's just something that I've like thought about. I've cried at work, and so I clearly, you know, have a stake in, I guess. And then, you know, I know my colleagues who have, and I just thought it would be an interesting thing to explore. Plus, there are all these gender differences. So, anytime you have that, you have like an interesting wrinkle of society to explore.
So, you interviewed one of your female colleagues, and here's what she had to say about why she cries at work.
For me, it's always a combination of being tired, being stressed, sort of getting in a mentality where I'm already feeling sorry for myself, and then in some way that becomes reinforced, and then I just get into a very woe is me frame of mind and then start crying.
And so in talking with her, did what she said causes her to cry ring true with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was kind of surprising for me was actually that everyone that I talked to, you know, I for the video I mostly talked to my colleagues, seemed to have a different reason for crying at work. So some people it wasn't anything about their job per se. Some people it was, you know, kind of feeling sorry for themselves because of all the stress. You know, for others it was just like they felt like their, you know, manager or whoever wasn't hearing them well and, you know, or understanding them, so they got frustrated with the situation. You know, so it was just sort of interesting to hear all the different reasons why people cried. So I feel like there's no hard and fast rule there.
Well, Susan from Cedarburg is on the line, so let's go to the phones. Susan, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I had an experience where working, I would get frustrated, perhaps a little bit angry with my interactions with people and feeling like I needed to cry as a release for my emotions, but I would never do it with other people seeing me just because I think that would be judged very poorly. But I would go into the woman's bathroom and release, you know, just cry and let myself kind of release those emotions. And what I found was it really helped me to get over those that feeling quicker than had I tried to keep suppressing it and dealing with it in amongst other people. And so I was then able to go back to, you know, back to my desk and face that situation in a little bit better mindset, I felt.
And Susan, when you said that you didn't want to do it in public in front of your coworkers, did you have more concern about crying in front of male or female coworkers, or did it have the same kind of level of risk to you?
Same level. To me, it didn't matter. It's just something you don't do in the workplace. Earlier in my career, I worked predominantly with men, so maybe that's why I think that. And in fact, I once had a manager tell me that I was too emotional, even though I never cried or did what I considered emotional activities in the workplace. But yes, as someone just said, I think men are viewed upon differently. If a man gets very emotional and angry and raises his voice, it's okay. And a woman's not allowed to do that.
Well, thanks for that call, Susan. And Olga Kazan, what would you say to Susan?
I think that's a great, you know, striking a nice balance. You know, if you feel like you need to get those emotions out, you know, because you're getting frustrated, but you know, aren't someone who's comfortable with your colleagues seeing you cry, maybe it would you know, be a good solution to go to the bathroom and sort of cry privately. A lot of people are bathroom criers, I think, for that reason. So, yeah, I think that's a good solution for people who feel that way.
We're talking with Olga Kazan about her recent article for The Atlantic about crying at work. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And one thing that Susan said was that crying helped, getting it out helped, and you really echoed that, Olga. Sometimes people will refer to crying at work as letting your emotions get the best of you. Do you think that's true?
Well, I definitely don't think it's true that crying means you're letting your emotions get the best of you. But I'm also not sure what that means. I mean, people are emotional, and, you know, we have emotions wherever we go. We have positive emotions. We have negative emotions. I think crying might be better than some of the other negative emotions you might feel, like the desire to undermine someone or to gossip about someone. You know, so in that sense, I think crying is probably preferable. But, you know, my manager is actually in this video, and he was talking about how, like, well, you know, why wouldn't people cry at work? Because, like, all your emotions happen at work. So, yeah, I guess I don't really think that.
So you did talk to female colleagues, but you also talked to male colleagues. And this is what one of your male colleagues had to say about crying at work.
If I'm crying at work and it's like an uncontrollable situation, like, I don't want it to be happening. I'll always be like trying to like make myself.
So, Olga, what do you hear from men who feel the need to cry but don't really feel like they should be giving up that power?
Well, I talked to two of my, as far as like, I talked to two of my male managers and then two male coworkers, and neither of the male coworkers had cried because of like work-related problems. They had both cried because of kind of either personal issues or just like things that were making them emotional at work. One of them has like a very emotional beat, so I think it like was hard for him sometimes to just like listen to his interviews. And one of them, like, you know, really, he cried at work once and he felt really embarrassed about it. You know, but everyone else seemed really kind of like accepting of it and really, you know, consoled him and everything. And the other one said that he tries not to cry at work, but it still happens sometimes, and he just sort of hides behind his computer. I thought, but they did sort of make it sound like they really tried not to do it. And actually the women did too. The women were saying that they would do anything to not be crying. But it seemed like they didn't feel like it was as maybe as bad, you know, like the men really seemed to think that like you should be stoic at work. You shouldn't be crying, you know.
We're talking with Olga Kazan from The Atlantic now about crying from work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever seen one of your colleagues cry at work? And did it change your opinion of them? How did you react? And if you've ever cried at work, what prompted you to feel the need to cry? And how did people take it? Do you think it should be okay to cry in the workplace? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation now with Olga Kazan from The Atlantic about crying at work. And Olga, we have some callers on the line, so let's go to the phones. Evelyn in Kenosha is up first. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share my, you know, experience with crying at work. I started my career quite early on, and I worked in a professional setting, you know, in my early 20s. And I believe when I first started out, if things at work were, you know, it got to me, or if I found something frustrating, I would be more emotional. And I have had instances at work where I cried, or I got overly emotional at the verge of crying, where I would fight tears till I like try to get to a place where I could be by myself. But I feel like as I got older, I've learned to channel that differently. So rather, yes, you know, things will happen at work where you get frustrated, but rather than crying or rather than being emotional, I try to compartmentalize it and try to deal with it in a different way. And one of the reasons I did that is because I believe crying at work does affect you and how others view you. And I feel like it makes you you're viewed weak or overly emotional, and it might stand in your way to leadership positions, especially as a woman, because, I mean, I've only seen women cry, and I have never actually, to date, met or worked with somebody who's a man who's cried, and I feel like the perception of women crying at work makes you look weak and less of a leadership candidate.
Well, thanks for those comments, Evelyn. And Olga, I'm guessing that you might say that's part of the reason why we need to look at why there's this taboo and whether it is based in sexist attitudes.
Yeah, I mean, she's absolutely right. Women are judged harshly for crying at work. They're in several studies, or in one study that was specifically workplace-based, the sort of, you know, it was sort of like negative to cry in a performance review or basically like any kind of work setting, but to cry about like a personal tragedy was like sometimes acceptable. But, you know, it was sort of like for the women, they were viewed as emotional and lacking in control, while the men, I guess, were kind of humanized by crying. So it is definitely quite sexist, and it can hold you back at work. That's why I think people should stop judging work criers.
Let's go back to the phones, and Deborah in Brown Deer is up next. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Well, I'm not a bathroom crier. I just want to establish that. But I think crying is like laughing. It's something you just have to do. It's a bodily function, and I've seen men in the past month or two, like three political leaders crying, or almost like tears welled up in President Obama's eyes when he was referring to his daughters. I watched the Nancy Reagan's funeral, and of course, I guess it's okay for men to cry and women at a funeral, but I don't know. I feel like it's such a normal function. I don't know, understand what the problem is, and I think it's really when you're sincerely crying, it just, you can't help it. It just comes out.
Well, thanks for that comment, Deborah. Olga?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. And actually, it's really common. 41% of women, according to this one study, admitted to crying at work. That's those who admitted to doing it. So the real number is probably actually higher. And 9% of men, for some of the reasons that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. So when you have 40% of the population doing something, I don't think it's like this terrible taboo thing anymore. Like it's, you know, it's just a normal human part of life.
It does get very interesting with men. And let's hear what one of your male colleagues had to say about crying at work.
I feel like you have to be stoic at work. I do cry. It's just like going to a conference room and closing the door.
Why do you feel like you have to be stoic at work?
I don't know. I feel like there's a stigma attached to it. A coworker has seen me tear up while reading like a story, or maybe it was like a kitten video, and that was the thing that he mentioned for the rest of the months that we were coworkers.
So that's really interesting. So he feels like showing that emotion and in front of another man, really, he could never shake that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think he sort of did live it down. Like, I think he's being a little bit facetious, maybe. But, you know, one of my male managers at the same time said that the stress of managing people, like, sometimes makes him cry, actually, in front of other people. So, you know, it really runs the gamut. Like, you can't, you know, it's different for everyone. So, you know, he told some really poignant stories about times when, you know, two of his direct reports wanted, you know, two totally different things, and he had to make a decision that would really impact both of their lives. And, you know, definitely the pressure of that can get to you.
Let's go back to the phones and Jan in Burlington. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just going to relay a story. I spent 39 years in corporate America, and during, you know, if you're in business for that long, you will go through downsizing, and those can be very gut-wrenching, emotional. You know, especially when people are escorted out of the building, they come into work one day, have no clue of what's going to happen. And we had what was literally a bloodbath like that one day. And I really respected a male coworker of mine who was also a manager. He called me aside and he said, "I never thought I'd cry at work. And I cried today."
Mm-hmm. So it feels like, even if men cry less, it doesn't mean that there aren't those times that they feel moved to. And Olga, how are men perceived when they cry at work?
So for the one study, there wasn't enough men actually who did so for her to find a significant difference. But just something that this researcher noticed was that the people had, like, universally better responses to the men crying. They said things like, it made me feel closer to him, or it humanized him. And then kind of out in the world, so not at work, men are perceived more positively than women when they cry. But specifically when they not full-on cry, but sort of, like, tear up or look kind of misty-eyed.
Get choked up, maybe.
So get choked up. Like, that is, like, very, very, that's, like, the most positive possible outcome is to be a man who's, like, choked up.
Well, and as part of your research for this article, you actually talked to an actor to get some tips on how to prevent tears. And what advice did he have?
He sort of suggested sort of taking deep breaths and getting really grounded and putting both of your feet on the floor and sort of, trying to center yourself, which I think is good advice, except I feel like I would never remember to do that next time I felt like a cry coming on.
So people perceive crying at work differently based on gender, as we've been talking about. So what do you think needs to change, or can these really deeply ingrained prejudices or perceptions be changed to make it okay for anyone to cry at work?
I mean, look, this article is aspirational. I don't think it's, legislation is not going to be passed saying you have to let people cry at work. I just hope that it's like a gradual social change. But I think, you are seeing, another manager of mine that I talked to said, when people cried in front of him, it used to make him really uncomfortable. But now he sort of just, offers them a Kleenex and sort of waits it out, and it's sort of fine for him. I mean, maybe it's not totally fine, but he's a little bit more comfortable with it. You do see, like, even within individual people, them kind of changing how they view crying at work. And I think that's a good thing. I think people just shouldn't get so freaked out about it.
I think it's interesting, going back to those high-level female business leaders who are saying, there's no room for crying at work. Keep it at home, do it off the clock, basically. It almost makes me wonder if, because they have probably had to leave behind some of their more female characteristics to rise to those levels, if maybe they've kind of adopted that male perception of crying and whether it's acceptable or not.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting you say that, because you do see that among women who get to be in really, high leadership positions, is that a lot of times they do sort of try to blend in with the men and sort of just do whatever the men think should be done. So you do get that among women at high levels. But I think Sheryl Sandberg, actually, who's also obviously a very high-level woman, said that she has cried at work and she thinks it's fine. So even there you have sort of a range of attitudes. So it's all about just letting those more permissive or more accepting attitudes flourish.
And so just in the last couple of minutes that we have left, what would you suggest to people who see someone who might look like they're needing to cry but clearly don't feel comfortable? What would you, have you learned yourself, Olga, how to approach people who maybe feel this need at work and don't really feel comfortable?
I guess I would just say, if I'm trying to have a meeting with them, I would say, are you okay? Offer them a Kleenex, if I have one, and then say, do you want to take a break? Do you want to, not have this conversation right now? But if they say, no, it's okay, let's just keep going, which is what I've heard is usually what people say, then I think you just kind of, treat it like they're smiling or like they're, laughing or whatever else people might be doing with their face.
And maybe not trying to fix the situation in that moment, but just kind of being there for someone.
Yeah, just sort of accept that that's just what they're going through.
Well, Olga, thanks so much for being with us. It was a really interesting conversation.
Good, I'm glad. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Olga Kazan, staff writer at The Atlantic. She was with us to talk about her recent piece about crying at work. You can get to that article on a link on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also keep the conversation going there with your thoughts about crying in the workplace. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then a look at Governor Walker's comments on a contested GOP convention and how it could lead to a presidential nominee who's not currently running. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.